Greetings, Topher Delaney here. Greetings, Topher Delaney here with our terrific podcast, Garden the Knowledge. And we are honored today to be with Alexis Kotafet, who is the proprietress and farmer and activist and leader of the agricultural community here in Solano County, California. And the name of the farm is the Soul Food Farm, which is really indicative of the ethos that is here. Alexis, greetings.
Hello, thank you for inviting me to talk today. I appreciate it.
So Alexis, we were just chatting earlier about your family. Would you like to give us a little background of your parents?
Absolutely. My mother is from Peru. And my dad's history is that he is Assyrian and also Scottish. So they were very passionate and insightful and smart people. And they were very much environmental activists back when I was growing up and were very interested in law, were very interested in rural lands. They were also very intellectual, and the fact that they were often discussing politics at the table, poetry. My sisters and I grew up this sort of very enmeshed life of thinking and feelings. We didn't have a TV growing up, so it was just the natural outcome that we would sit around the table and listen to our parents talk about the things that interested them and projects they were involved in.
When you say when you grew up, did you grow up in the States?
I did. I was born in San Francisco and spent time in my grandmother's house, what was our family home. And then my parents decided to move out of the city in 1964, and they found a ranch-style house in Danville, which is very fancy-schmancy now, but back in the 60s, Danville was very rural. So we had horses, and we had chickens and dogs and cats and lots of land to run around. That's where we were raised and went to school in the next town. My mother liked us to be in private schools, but we grew up in the country, running around and staying out till 10 o'clock, riding our bikes and just having a regular childhood.
How old were you when you moved to Danville?
I think I was 2.
So you're quite young.
I was a little one, yeah.
When you said your mother liked privatized education,
yeah.
What school did you go to?
So my sisters and I went to St. Mary's School in Walnut Creek for elementary school. And then I was terribly naughty. So then she put me in a born-again Christian school to straighten me out. And that my behavior worse.
What is naughty?
I think back then in the 70s when you're in fifth grade and you've got a really dirty mouth, like lots of swearing. I think my mother thought I was going to go to hell. So she put me in a very strict school, which was fine. I had a great education. It was wonderful, actually. I had my childhood best friend. And, you know, you're kids. You don't really think too much about where you're at. You just go to school, do your lessons, and play with your friends. And then I went to Carondelet High School in Pleasant Hill, which is an all-girls Catholic school. Again, a great education and made close friendships there that I still have to this day and are so important to me that I have these long friendships with women since I was 15.
And you have how many sisters?
I have 2 sisters. My older sister is a veterinarian and an author, and she lives about an hour and a half away from here. And she also owns a farm and has built a beautiful place for her to live, a beautiful home she designed and built, and a beautiful property.
And what's her name?
My older sister's name is Elida.
Elida.
Yeah. And she was named after my great-great-grandmother, whose portrait is sitting behind us.
Oh, yeah. And she's quite a lovely woman.
Yeah, that's Elida DeLong, and my sister was named after her.
Where is Elida DeLong from?
Elida DeLong was originally from Virginia. Her name was Elida Vineyard, and she married Charles DeLong. And that's a whole other thing. Charles DeLong ended up being considered the first ambassador to Japan, and was the first Caucasian diplomat to have a private audience with the Mikado. So that's a whole other part of my ancestry that's quite fascinating. He was an interesting man. And then you asked about my sister's names. My younger sister is named Inez, and she lives in Merida, Mexico, and she's very immersed in a nonprofit called Los Mayas Eternos. And they work with the Mayan people down in the Yucatan, helping them protect and promote their culture.
All of you seem to share a relationship to your immediate community and larger community, being the environment perhaps. Could you speak to that? You all seem to have a thread: veterinarian, farm, soul food farm, Los Mayas Eternos. What do you attribute this to? Do you think this is true?
I think that it is actually true. We grew up in a very difficult way.
What is difficult?
Not my father, but our mother mistreated us quite severely. And without getting into details, we asked bigger questions at a very young age. Like, what does it mean to be happy? And what does it mean to socialize well with others? And what does it mean to get along with others? And my father was always telling us to do our duty, to understand what our duty was, to not argue. If we complained, he would say, oh, you're one of those. And I would say, what's one of those? He said, a complainer. And that really pulled me up short. Mm-hmm. He would often say, do your duty. To the end of his life, he was always telling my sisters and I, do your duty. And then he was often telling us, overcome your emotions, use your mind, think about why you're doing things, think about your response. You don't always have to talk. You can pause. And he told us those things when we were younger and we didn't understand. And then as we became adults, we realized what a wise individual he was. And we came to him until the end of his life and asked him for guidance. And I think when he was gone, we realized that we had to take those lessons and choose the kind of life we wanted for ourselves. And not just intellectualize it, but actualize it. Luckily, the three of us all together have realized that life is better when you share it with others. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of healing that comes when you work outside with your hands. And so all of us left a garden. And I think that's just instinctual that we find some connection with nature. And we all like to be of service. I think as we now reach our 60s, we've realized that it's better to be of service and to do things with a broader perspective than to just do things for ourselves. But this has taken a long time to learn. We're all in our 60s, so it's taken a lifetime. And we're still learning. We're still finding our way. That's what it's all about, right?
Isn't a farm eternal?
Yeah. My dad was 97 when he passed away. And
what year was that?
2017. And even at the end of his life, he was still telling me that he was learning things. And I thought, oh, that made such an impression on me when he told me that. I was like, oh, it's your whole life you're learning. Your whole life you're trying to improve yourself. So be gentle with yourself a little bit because you don't have to figure it out all at one time.
So your three sisters, you grow up in somewhat of a rural area in Danville.
Yeah, it was all cattle and cowboys. And people thought you were a real hick when you lived in Danville in the 60s. So we would go to school in Walnut Creek, and then my sister would end up in fights in the schoolyard. And then I think in fourth or fifth grade, she's like, stop telling people we live in Danville, because you were just a hillbilly. It's so funny to imagine now, because Danville's so lush and high-end, and it's one of the most expensive places to live in the country. But back in the day, you were just a hick if you lived there.
So you grew up in Hicksville,
yeah,
a.k.a. Danville. And do you have a garden there? Do you have a farm? Do you have any brush with flower growing, sheep, cattle?
So my parents ended up buying a huge piece of property. Well, childhood memories always exaggerate everything. Maybe it was 5 or 6 acres, but the way it was laid out seemed immense. So there was a walnut orchard. There were bridges over a creek. There was a fruit orchard. There was another bridge that took you to a huge riding arena. And then behind that was hundreds of acres of grazing land and hills that belonged to a rancher. Mm-hmm. So this was this expansive place. And we just grew up there surrounded by nature, playing outside all the time. We grew up really in the country, sliding down the hill on cardboard and riding our bikes around.
You're familiar with land.
Yeah.
You grew up being familiar.
Yeah, we weren't planting things and farming, but we were in the country. And that gets under your skin when you are surrounded by trees and plants and open fields and playing in a creek. That just all sort of gets into you in its own way.
You mentioned your parents were activists or politically engaged. What was their focus and what was it that you were listening to?
So when I was maybe 9 or 10, my parents were told that the Contra Costa County Flood Control District had condemned our land, eminent domain, and they were going to take it. And I think they thought at the time that my mother was from another country and didn't speak great English, and they could just kind of get away with this. I think the story is that they even told her so late that she had missed any kind of legal avenue she had to get a stay in a court of law. But they didn't know my mother. My mother was a force to be reckoned with. And between her and my dad, they took the Contra Costa County Flood Control District to court for 10 years. They won all their lawsuits. Unfortunately, the property was condemned. Bulldozers did come in and destroy it. But my parents were so forceful in their opposition to what had happened that they won all their lawsuits. And now people to this day who have these kinds of cases can go back and review their lawsuits and use it as a defense against eminent domain on their own properties. After that, my mother became quite passionate about the 680 corridor.
What is 680?
So 680 is a highway that's been designated a scenic highway that runs along part of the East Bay. And back in the 70s or 80s, they started building cement walls all along the 680 scenic corridor. My parents were horrified and tried to stop it. And so my mother became very active in trying to protect the scenic corridor. She was threatened to stop, but she persevered. So my parents taught my sisters and I in a very grounded and very real way that if you see wrongdoing, you stand up for it, even if it means that it costs you a lot of money or you're going to be frightened or it's going to take years of your life. Like if you see an injustice, it's your job to stand up for the things that you believe in. And so they were quite remarkable and sort of ahead of their time in that way.
And this was in the 60s?
The eminent domain and our land be taken away was in the 70s. I was 10, so it must have been 1974.
As I listen to you, I'm struck by their engagement in the land and to stand up for the justice of land.
Mm-hmm.
There are many areas of injustice, and there doesn't seem to be a voice for land. What do you think of that concept?
I agree that the land relies on human beings to be their advocate. Mm-hmm. The trees, the soil, animals, they are all reliant on humans to advocate for them. And people do that work all over the world in different ways and in different capacities.
And so if we bring that home to Pleasance Valley Road here, which, by the way, for all of you listening, Alexis, can you share with our community the availability to come here?
Yeah, so Soul Food Farm is open to the public 3 days a week, and we have a farm stand, and people can come and sit in the gardens and walk in the olive orchard. It's sort of been a wonderful privilege these last 3 years to open the farm up to the public because it's such a big place, and Eric and I do want to share it with people.
Who is Eric?
Eric's my sweet partner and husband who makes sure that through good and bad, we keep the farm and that I can do my work here. It wouldn't be here if it wasn't for his utter devotion to me and to the things that make me happy. He's really the best.
What is his profession?
Eric's an engineer, and he's put up with all my ideas all these years. When we first found the farm, actually it was just land, and when I first found it, I went straight home and told Eric we needed to sell everything and buy it. And he's like, that's never going to happen. And then 2 years later, because I was just relentless, and he finally came out here and saw it. And when he saw it, he understood.
What year is this?
I saw it for sale, I think, in 1995. And finally, in 1997, he agreed that we should go for it. And we found a way to buy it.
How old were you then?
I was about 37, 38 at the time.
And where were you living?
We lived in Vallejo. We lived in a beautiful house from 1916 on a quarter acre. We had our three kids. We were having a great time. We were friends with all our neighbors. We were having parties all the time and drinking coffee on Sundays with our neighbors and gardening. And we were just having a ball.
You mentioned three children.
Yes. Eric and I have our son, Justin. Our eldest daughter is Emma, and our youngest daughter is Morgan. They're all adults now, doing really well. But at the time, they were small kids. And it was a huge deal to move out to a piece of land that didn't even have a house on it and start from scratch.
So, sounds like your parents.
You know, Eric's a very calm man, and he likes things to be predictable. And I come from people who are very emotional and take big risks. So.
What nationality is your father?
My father was Assyrian in Scottish. So Eric and I have had to really work at figuring out what our rhythm is.
What I meant by that was, how old were your children?
At the time, our son was 15. Our oldest daughter, she must have been about 12 or 13, and our youngest was around 6 or 7.
So what I'm referencing is that your parents moved from San Francisco to Hicksville.
Yeah. And then we did something very similar.
And in a way, which is kind of interesting as I hear you share your story, is there you are in Vallejo with three children. Your parents had three children.
Yeah.
And you go to basically Hicksville.
Yeah. You know, I didn't ever connect those dots. And you're absolutely right. It seems so obvious now.
Somehow you've got this good life in Vallejo. Great community. You lived in Vallejo for how long?
11 years.
11 years.
It was a ball. It was probably one of the best times of my life. We had fun, like real fun.
So you're having fun. You have the children. And somehow, how much land is for sale?
So what happens is while I'm living in Vallejo, I'm gardening. I'm obsessed with gardening, and I know there's a nursery up at the end of this road. So I would drive 25 minutes from Vallejo up to Vacaville to shop for plants at Morningsun Herb Farm. And I saw this property for years. And as I drove past it, I would always say to myself, whoever lives there is so lucky. Whoever owns that land is so lucky.
Why did you say that?
It was just so stunningly beautiful. There was no house on it. There were just old barns and some cattle grazing on it. It'd been deserted since the 60s, so it was very wild. And I just thought it was beautiful. And then one day when I was driving to get plants, there was a for sale sign on it, and I literally lost my mind. I slammed on the brakes. The kids still remember, like, they flew through the car. I slammed on the brakes. I took the name down of the realtor and went home and told Eric we should sell everything and buy this piece of property. And he was like, bring it down a notch. Calm down, lady. And so for 2 years, I did everything I could to figure out how to buy it. And in that time, other people made offers on it. And it was in escrow 3 times in those 2 years. And the deals kept falling through. Finally, Eric agreed that we should buy it. And by 1997, we had purchased it.
And what was the purchase price?
It was $400,000 for 55 acres. And we didn't have that kind of money. I don't know how we did it when I think about it now.
Did you have a mortgage on it?
I think what we did was we bought it and the owners held the note. And then we had no house, so we were camping out here with our kids.
What kind of camping?
Literally camping.
Oh, yeah. Like tents?
Yeah.
Where did the children go to school?
They went to school in town, and the bus would pick them up at the driveway, and they were so mortified.
Eventually, why were they mortified?
Because we were camping.
Intense.
So yes. Eventually, Eric and I got some William Scotsman trailers, which made them even more mortified.
What is a William
Scotsman? It's like construction trailers you see on construction sites that they turn into offices.
I see.
We rented those and put them on the farm. And we were trying to get a construction loan, and we were just having a hard time. So it ended up that we camped out here in trailers for 4 years. And our son, he was 15, he would get dropped off way down at the end of Pleasance Valley Road in front of a really beautiful house that's down there and tell his friends that was his house. The girls were like, we hate you. It was just chaos and disarray.
And what city, when you said they went to school in...
In Vacaville.
Oh, in Vacaville.
Yeah. And so what ends up happening is that we're camping and we're totally discouraged and we can't get a construction loan. And we've bitten off more than we can chew, and we're failing. And our next door neighbor, who lives right across that field, would come and check on us. And one day he came over and he said, what are you going to do? And I said, there's nothing we can do. We don't qualify for construction loan. We've bitten off more than we can chew. We've made a terrible mistake. And he said, I am tired of you feeling sorry for yourself. I am coming back in 3 hours, and I am digging the footings for your house. And I said, why bother? We can't get the loan. He said, that's not the answer. You have to make your way. And he came back in 3 hours and he dug the footings for our house. And the next day I went to get a construction loan. And by the end of the week, we had a construction loan. I don't know how that happened. All the forces of the universe just sort of came together and we had a construction loan and we built our house in 2005. And I just don't know how it all happened, but I always remember this man.
And what's his name?
His name was Don Ritchie. It was just a gift. It was a huge gift for someone to come over and care and watch over us in that way.
And did he keep coming over?
You know, he sold his property a couple years later, and I've never seen him since, really. But that was just a moment in time where we needed somebody to shake us. With a backhoe. And to shake us a little. Since telling us to stop moping. Sometimes you just need someone to shake you a little bit.
And give you a hand. Don Ritchie gives you a hand, drives his backhoe over, and you must have had plans for the house to dig a footing.
So when we had found the property and we were buying it, Eric had a lot of money in stocks. So we felt really money flush. We were in the middle of escrow for the property and the stock market crashes in 97. I don't know if we remember that.
I do.
And in a few days, Eric and I lost everything. So we had architectural drawings, and we were in the middle of escrow to buy this land, and suddenly we're flat broke, busted, done, and we're in the middle of a mess. So we moved on the farm, and we had these beautiful drawings for a house, but we're starting at zero now. And that's okay. I look back on that now, and I think, you know, I'm glad we didn't build that big fancy house.
Oh, was it a bigger house than what you have now?
And I'm glad we camped on the farm. I think we all, my kids and Eric and I, we learned resilience. We learned how to stick together. We learned some lessons there about life that were invaluable. And I think it was all for the best. We didn't have TVs. We didn't have computers. We all had to just learn to communicate in a different way.
Well, you did grow up without a television.
For me, it was no problem. For my kids, I think they felt like, what do you mean no TV and computers and no technology and we're living in trailers? I think for them, it was a real shocker. But they're adults now, and I look at them in their lives now, and I see them so capable and so socially connected and so responsible and so smart that I think, maybe that was a helpful moment for them. They learned something about themselves.
Resilience boot camp.
It kind of was. And Eric and I learned some resilience too. And we found out that we had to stick together. It would have been really easy at moments of our marriage to just say, let's get a divorce. This isn't working. But the circumstances of this farm kept us together. And I'm so glad we learned something about ourselves.
Well, a bigger mission than just the unit of the family, which is very important, of course.
And also the idea that it's okay if life is difficult. Why do we avoid it and feel that we failed in some way? It's okay. Life is hard and that's all right too. And things worth having take sacrifice. And this farm was worth having.
So did you plant the olive orchard?
We did. When we bought the property and moved out here, and we're living in trailers, and my parents thought we were nuts. My sister, Elida, thought that it would be a really wonderful idea to plant some olive trees as a family. So she's great. She says, let's plant 50 trees. But of course, I'm the middle child. I'm like, 50? Let's plant 250. And she's like,
what is that response?
She's always conservative.
Yeah.
And I'm the middle child going, let's go crazy. Yeah. Let's jump off the cliff. So we planted 250 olive trees. My parents helped us plant the trees. Our kids helped. And that whole orchard is really a reflection of our family and the work we did putting that orchard together with the idea we would produce olive oil in the future. So that's really a family project.
So why did you put the olive orchard on the site next to the road?
When we moved on to the farm, even though the original farmhouse was gone, there were certain trees on the property that those original homesteaders in the 1850s had planted, and one of them was an olive tree. And so that area where our olive orchard is now was just an empty field, but it had this 100-year-old or 150-year-old olive tree just growing in the middle of it. So that just seemed the perfect spot to plant the grove. And so she's still there and she's in the middle of the olive grove and she's quite magnificent.
What kind of olive?
We don't know.
Oh.
I've always say this. I'm going to take it to get tested. I've never done it, but we don't know what it is.
So there's a place you can test olives.
Yeah, UC Davis.
Oh, great.
So someday we'll take it, but we don't include those olives in the olive oil we produce. We only include the olives that are from the trees we planted.
What kind of olives do you
have? So we have Frantoio, Licino, and Pendolino olives. And that's the combination that we blend together for our olive oil that
and
we produce.
Why those?
My sister really wanted to do something that was very Italian-style olive oil, and these are considered the Tuscan varietals. And we wanted an olive oil that sort of had those grassy, peppery notes mm-hmm. of a good Italian oil. Mission olives, the way I understood it, gives you sort of a richer, more buttery kind of oil. And that didn't really particularly interest us. So that was the decision to choose those varieties.
And how big were they when you put them
They in? Were what we call whips. So just like a branch. If you don't know what a whip is, it's just like a long branch with some shoots, and that's what we planted.
Like a foot.
Yeah, tall. And now it's been 24 years, 25 years since we planted them.
When did you start harvesting your olives?
From whips, it takes about 7 years. So we tended those trees for 7 years before we ever got our first small harvest that was worth taking to a mill. And now, I think last November in 2023, I think we pressed 6,000 pounds, something like that. We ended up with hundreds of gallons of olive oil.
So. And is that every year the same? Do you keep your olives topped?
Our harvest changes every year based on how we pruned the orchard, but also on the conditions at bloom time. So I think in 2019, we had zero harvest because there was a huge windstorm that came and blew all the blooms off the trees. So there was no buds to grow. And then there was another year where we had a similar situation where we had a huge windstorm and then followed by a freeze. And so that was a very poor production of olives, and we didn't even harvest that year. So weather's changing, climate is changing, and so we have to adjust that along with how we prune and manage the trees. But the fluctuation is not always that severe. It's never a great harvest and zero olives. Usually the fluctuation is 200 gallons or 235 gallons, somewhere in there. Usually the fluctuation is a little bit narrower, but we only sell it from the farm stand. So that's inconsequential to me. I think the important thing about the olive grove is that we're producing olives as a family farm. We're dry farming, so we're not
irrigating
with a limited resource. And we're managing the olive grove for flavor. It's not so much about having a massive production of olive oil that we sell in stores. It's more about producing something of quality that tastes good that we can sell here at the farm and talk to people about directly.
It's a nice way to bring people here.
Yeah.
If you have it in a store, my understanding would be that they're not really at the farm. And isn't your mission about being on the farm?
I want people to buy olive oil and then go walk in the olive orchard and then sit under a tree. So we have benches out there. I want people to connect with the sense of place. Not necessarily the most important thing is to buy something. I think the most important thing about being here is to feel what it means to be connected to nature.
What I have remarked on in my visits to your farm is that I see families here, but I don't see families buying things. I see families investigating the rabbits and the sheep, and then they're seem to be herding the sheep, and they're looking at raised beds of in this season, which is the mid-spring, the ranunculus and digitalis and all sorts of salvias, it looks like, and herbs. They're looking.
Yeah.
And they seem to be sitting at these very nice picnic tables, not overly fancy, but they're sitting with their multi-generational. Is that right?
Yeah. I think that's a great observation. And it's the one Eric and I want to continue to cultivate, that people can come here and feel that they are part of this and to feel comfortable in this natural environment.
I also have noticed that there are many ethnicities here. As I've come, I've been very surprised at the cultural mix, that I see these multi-generational families of all nationalities here, which I am very surprised by. Many farms, we don't really see that.
No?
Well, a lot of the farms are maybe not accessible. Seem to be quite accessible to a highway.
I think that's our lucky break, is that the highway is literally just a moment away. It's around the corner.
It's not difficult to get here.
No, not at all. And we welcome people from all ethnic groups because I'm an ethnic woman. I come from a hodgepodge. I always tell people I'm a mutt. Latin and Scottish and Middle Eastern. I don't find any place to live my life where I can feel so privileged that I would want to exclude others. And that is America. We are a diverse and interesting country. And I feel so happy when people come here and I see all the colors and all the shades and all the orientations, young and old, all of it. That to me is humanity and humankind. And it makes me really, really happy. I can't imagine living a life where you're not connected to the world around you. And since I don't want to get in a car and go drive around, I'm so happy that people have found their way here to the farm instead. That's really the success of Soul Food Farm, is that people have found their way here.
They have found their way. But when you first started this farm, didn't you have chickens here?
Oh, Lordy. Well, Soul Food Farm's first big farming success and farming work was that we were a pasture chicken farm.
Pasture chicken?
Yeah.
What is that?
So we were the largest pasture chicken farm in California for many years. And that's when you're raising birds outside where they can move in the fields and express themselves naturally and be outdoors. And so you're just farming on a really large scale. So we had 15,000 chickens.
15,000?
Yeah.
What did you start out with?
Well, we started out with a few, and then that grew and grew, and then finally I got some restaurant accounts.
Hold on. Did you have experience with chickens?
No. Listen, I was not even going to be a farmer. I had some randy-dandy idea that I was going to own all this land and be the landed gentry and have staff. And then I found out I'm the staff and I have to do the work. And everything went askew and we ended up having chickens. And then I was selling eggs to, I don't know, people at the bank. And then a girlfriend of mine worked at Chez Panisse and she came over to visit one day and said, do you mind if I take some of these?
And what is Chez Panisse?
Chez Panisse is this just incredible restaurant in Berkeley, run by an amazing team, founded by many wonderful people. Alice Waters is probably the most notable founder of Chez Panisse. Anybody who wanted to be a chef or to really learn their craft of beautiful cuisine would work at Chez Panisse. And my friend Nikki Ford was working there, but she would come here to visit me. We had other projects with each other.
Like what other project?
We had an underground dinner club that we used to do here at the farm.
What does that mean?
So she did the chefing, the cooking. I set the tables and made the venue. And there was another farmer down the road we bought all the produce from, another woman farmer. And we had this underground dinner club we used to do.
And how many people would come to the dinner club?
We would pre-sell tickets for 15 or 20. And then Nikki would cook these incredible courses.
Real farm to table.
Really beautiful. That was back in maybe 2005. And I'd choose all the wines. And Laura, who was a farm at the time, would produce all the food. And it was special.
And I'm gathering you did not continue this.
No, it was a short-lived thing because what ends up happening is Nikki takes my eggs back to Chez Panisse. The next day they call and ask to buy every egg we have on the farm. And then this whole world opened up where Eric and I started producing pastured eggs for really beautiful restaurants in the Bay Area.
Wait. So the Underground Dinner Supper Club is retired.
Yes.
Because you're now selling eggs.
I'm farming all day.
All day. Now, where are you getting these chickens from?
I bought them as baby chicks and raised them.
From a chick store or what?
I bought them from a hatchery.
Hatchery.
Mm-hmm. And then they would be shipped here. And then for laying chickens, you have to raise them for 6 or 7 months before they lay their first eggs.
Do you have a chicken coop?
We had huge chicken houses on the farm that Eric built.
So you go to this hatchery.
They would ship the baby chicks.
How do you know what kind of chickens to get?
I just researched chickens that were good layers.
That's it? You just researched it?
Yes.
And then how much does a little chicken cost?
Oh, I think way back then you could buy a baby chick for $1.50. So I would buy them. The first big order was 500. Years down the road, orders would be like 1,000, 2,000 baby chicks.
And you would be buying 1,000, then 2,000, I see.
And I'd raise them for 7 months, and those would be the egg layers.
Then what happened?
So we would keep them for 2 years. We would sell eggs to all the restaurants and stores that we had contracts with. And at the end of those 2 years...
How many stores? I mean, I'm shocked.
I know. It is shocking. So what happens is this. We start off with Chez Panisse and La Limes in Berkeley, and then we keep expanding and taking on new clients. So I'm buying more baby chicks. And so eventually, at a certain point, we have 3,000 laying chickens on the farm, and we are selling 600 dozen eggs a week to 30 different restaurants in the Bay Area.
So you're packing the egg?
Yes. You're
driving them? Someone's driving them somewhere?
Me and you. Eric were the delivery people, were the chicken carers, were the washing the chicken people, egg people, were the packing the eggs.
That's right. You wash those eggs,
yes,
right?
Yes, we deliver them. This is our work. We are pasture chicken farmers, and we're selling pasture chicken eggs. And then to add more chaos to the story, Alice Waters and her amazing chef call me one day and say, would you raise some meat chickens for Chez Panisse? And I said no, and I hung up. And then I looked at Eric and I'm like, I just said no to Alice Waters. I think I've lost my mind. So I called her right back. And then she got a little hesitant. She's like, well, I don't know. And I'm like, I can raise meat chickens. And she goes, do you know how? I said, absolutely, totally can do it. Because she wanted meat chickens, pastured raised chickens for her restaurant because you couldn't buy them here. Nobody was doing that.
And what year was this?
It's hard to remember, maybe 2006, 2007. Nobody was doing that. And she had had them in New York and she wanted them. But I didn't know how to raise meat chickens. I lied.
It sounds like you're quite a good researcher.
I went to the library and got a book. There's no internet. There's no Facebook. There's no internet. There's no big Google search for pasture chickens. So I did it. But what I didn't tell anybody was that I went for it. I didn't tell Eric and I didn't tell Alice Waters. What I did was I figured out a system. I figured out how long I had to raise them. I figured out how to buy the baby chicks and divide them into 12 groups so that every week for 12 weeks, all those other stages would bump up so that for 12 weeks in a row, I would be able to harvest chickens if they liked them. And if they didn't like them, I was really screwed. I didn't tell Eric I'd spent all our savings doing this.
How much did you spend?
A lot of money.
Like $10,000?
Yeah, it was something like that. I had to build 12 houses for the chickens. I had to buy 12,000 meat birds at different stages. I had
Didn't
to buy
Eric
all the food.
Notice that there were some buildings being
He
built?
Realized that I was up to some shenanigans, but I think he was too scared to ask. So I raised the chickens, and then I called Alice's chef.
And who was the chef?
Cal. Cal was the chef, and he was checking on the project. But he thought I was just raising one batch for them to test. But I thought to myself, well, if they like that batch of chickens, I should have all these other chickens ready for the restaurant so they can just keep serving the chickens.
Well, we now know that you did a break stop at this property and were definitive on purchasing it, money or no money.
I know.
And now, rolling forward, it's thousands of chickens.
I know. I don't do anything with...
But you're figuring it out.
I'm figuring it out.
Are you good at math?
No, I'm terrible at math, or I'd have money. I have no math skills.
You seem to have a good structural skill, though.
I'm very good at organizing things.
Yeah.
And I like solving problems. Anyway, the end of the story is that...
There is no end to this story that I can see.
The first batch of chickens matures. I butcher them. I bring them to Cal at Chez Panisse.
Mean? Have you ever butchered a
chicken? No, it was awful. So I had to find a butcher because I couldn't butcher them myself.
Right.
I drew the line at that. So I found a Chinese butcher in Sacramento. It was in this really crazy part of Sacramento.
What's a crazy part of Sacramento?
This is back in 2006, 2007, just very industrial. And I had no business being down there. But I was down there at 4 a.m. with my birds. And I had to stand in the kill room because they didn't know how to kill and clean birds that were this valuable and expensive to produce. So I had to stand in the kill room with them while they did the birds. And then sometimes I would have to literally take the equipment out of their hand and show them how I wanted it done.
Wait a second. How do you know how you want it done?
Because I read it in a book.
Oh, you read it in a book. Okay.
And I have to make sure the
Making sure.
Yes, I know. It's such a crazy story. And then I had to make sure that they weren't breaking the birds.
What does that mean?
The way they were processing birds in that facility was for speed and efficiency. So they were a little rough, which is fine because that's their way of handling their business for their clientele, who they were selling to direct at the front of the facility. But I had to make sure that the birds that were processed for Chez Panisse were perfect. Nothing broken, no skin ripped, cleaned beautifully, perfect. So that requires you handling them in a different way and going slower. So I had to teach them how I wanted it done.
Did they charge you by bird or did they charge you by hour? How did they charge
you? By bird. And since I was slowing down the processing line, it was more expensive.
I see. So they saw you coming after a while.
I was not their favorite person, but they did it for me anyway.
How many birds?
I think the first order was 100 birds.
100 Maybe birds it was that 100 you had never done before.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. So I took them all cleaned and boxed and iced and beautiful to Chez Panisse and delivered them. Mm-hmm. And Cal said to me, we didn't want any roosters. We just wanted hens. And I froze. I was standing in the kitchen and I was horrified. And I looked at him.
What does that mean?
They only wanted to buy hens to serve on the menu. And my box was a mix of hens and roosters.
Can you tell the difference?
Yes. And so I said, well, why do you feel that way? And he goes, well, I had this chicken in Italy once and it was really tough. And I said, I promise you, this is nothing like that. This is something like you've never had before. He said, well, sit down in the dining room. We're going to cook up these chickens and sample them. So I sat there while they cooked them up and I was shaking. I thought, I'm in big trouble. And him and his sous chef and all the other people in the kitchen sampled the chickens. And then they came over to me and told me that was the most delicious thing they'd ever eaten. And I burst into tears. I cried and cried all the way home, relieved, happy that it was a success, but mostly just relieved. And then he said to me, when can I have more? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I have a whole field of chickens that I have raised just for you. And that was the beginning of the whole pasture chicken meat business. And within a few years, Eric and I were raising 12,000 meat birds and selling 1,000 of them every week to restaurants and stores all over the Bay Area.
Do you have a trucking company? How does this work?
It was an enormous amount of logistics. So we were buying 1,000 baby chicks every week to come in to raise and butchering and selling 1,000 meat birds that were sent to restaurants. We had a truck. We had silos full of food. It cost us about 20, 25 grand a month just for chicken feed. We were working 18-hour days.
Whoa.
It was an enormous, enormous thing. And in 2012, I shut it all down and said, I'm done. Because by that point, we were broke. And even though we were famous and we had these famous chickens and we had fed presidents and we had been on the menus of Michelin star restaurants and we'd had all this beautiful success being on the cover of magazines, the farm could not sustain it because every time fuel costs went up, feed prices went up. And every time that happens, our margins would just vanish. And it was just Eric and I. Physically, two people could just not continue the amount of physical labor it was requiring of us. And finally, in 2012, there was a drought in the Midwest. And the grain fields collapsed and the feed costs were going to go up. I think they said 15%, 20%. And at that point, I just knew we're done.
We can't do this.
We can't do this anymore.
And your children weren't involved in this.
No. And that was another thing looking back on that whole experience was that there were just those years that I had no time to spend with my kids. I had to just triage their needs as required because the farm was taking everything out of Eric and I that we had. And I think also at that point too, I have to be honest and just say that I was tired of killing animals. Mm-hmm. I was responsible for feeding people really good, nutritious food. That was my driving force. I'm doing something important. But also, I was responsible for animals dying and I got tired of taking on that responsibility for people.
That's pretty significant. So you had a large number.
I counted it up once, and over the course of those years, I was responsible for 250,000 chickens being processed on this farm. Mm-hmm. So all these things converged at one time. I was listening to the Huffington Post. They said grain prices are going to go up 15%. I'm like, we don't even have 15% left in our margin to absorb that cost anymore. And I walked in the kitchen and I looked at Eric and I'm like, we're done. And he goes, okay. And that was the end of it. It took months to dismantle the whole system. We were also in debt because their costs associated with running such an elaborate enterprise. And now we have no chickens to sell to pay for it. So it took several years to kind of clear all the debt out for grain costs and equipment costs and all of that. But eventually, by 2014-15, I was able to put most of all of that to rest. And I spent from 2012 to 2017 resting and taking care of my dad and looking at the farm and trying to figure out how to farm in a way that was easier and more enjoyable.
And your dad was...
Dad came to live with me here in 2013, right after we closed the chicken business down, and he passed away in 2017.
At what age?
I think he was 96 or 97.
So he was an elder statesman, as they
say. He really was. Even though he was like Mr. Magoo, his body was very tiny and frail, his mind was brilliant. He had an incredible IQ, and to the end of his life, he was writing essays, poetry, reading, having intellectual discussions, saying silly jokes, but his mind was intact, and it was a pleasure having him here. I learned a lot.
So you move from the chicken farm, and what do you think about over those years? What are your thoughts?
My thoughts, that I had failed, that I had disappointed the Bay Area, that I was lousy with money. I really just beat myself up for a couple years. I did something and I couldn't see it through to the end. I gave up too soon. Very bad self-talk, very negative self-talk. But I got over that and I look back now at that time in a completely different way now.
What changed?
I think growing up a little bit and realizing that there's no value in berating yourself. Everything is just an experience to learn from. Now I look back on that time and I think really nothing could grow when you were unhappy. Nothing good could grow in your business if you were so unhappy personally. And nothing can grow and be beautiful and creative when you're involved in killing things. I look back at that time as incredibly important, but not one I would ever revisit again.
I think perhaps, Alexis, you have to go through the fire, so to speak, to come out the other side. And you wouldn't have known about killing and how you relate to that until you'd done it, actually.
Right.
On a small scale either.
No, not. And I want to be clear, too. I'm not in the camp of being a vegan. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that each person has to do what works for them and what feels right for themselves. I think eating animals has an important role.
Why is that?
My view is that to say not to eat animals is a very privileged first world point of view. That animal protein in other countries is the only way they can survive and have the kind of level of nutrition that they need to be healthy. It's not for me to judge whether or not eating animals is right or wrong. I simply think that animals have a role to play. And even if you don't want to eat them, cows and ruminants have a role to play in managing grasslands and in building soil. And they have done many, many studies that show that if you are that person, that farmer, that employee that is required to process animals, it is a very difficult thing to do. And you're taking on a burden for society to do that so that people can benefit from good nutrition. But at some point, everyone who's involved in that work will feel that they need to back away from it.
So you dismantle your chicken business. You still have the olive grove.
Yeah.
Do you continue to harvest the olives?
Yes. So Eric and I decide that we're going to focus on our olive oil production. We've always harvested olives and made olive oil, but nobody really knew that because the chickens had overshadowed everything else here on the farm. So we continue to do that and sell olive oil at a few select shops in Oakland and in San Francisco.
Could you really say some of them?
Yes, absolutely. So Star Grocery carried our olive oil, and we were so happy to be there. And Avadanos in San Francisco carried our olive oil, and other really wonderful woman-owned business, small neighborhood store, and that felt really comfortable. And then the rest of the olive oil we were selling here at the farm, and that felt good. That felt manageable because I was taking care of Dad and really needed to be here on the farm all the time. And during those years while Dad was here, I was really thinking about how to redesign this farm to be a place where it felt satisfying and where my work felt joyful. How do I find the joy in farming again after the upheaval of being a pasture chicken farm? So right around that time, the woman who owns Morning Sun Herb Farm, Rose, she and I are good friends, and we decide we're going to start a lavender business together. She's very knowledgeable about lavender, and I have the land. So we start a little lavender company called Herbas y Flores, Herbs and Flowers.
Herbas y Flores.
And we plant it here on Soul Food Farm, and we have these little lavender U-picks, and that seems really satisfying.
How many lavender plants now that you've had the chickens? I'm just wondering how many.
Yeah,
it's more than five, I'm guessing.
Of course, it had to be. We had to put in, I don't know, 1,000 or something.
But
of course, it's never a small number. But
yes,
the wonderful thing about the lavender, which was sort of this little epiphany, was I would wake up in the morning and they were exactly where I put them. Nothing's running around, nothing's died, nothing's hiding in the grass. It's not like chickens. I woke up every morning, my lavender field looked exactly the way I left it. Everything's exactly the way it should be. And I really started to get very interested in planting more plants on the farm.
And what type of lavender did you grow?
So Rose and I chose, almost 10 different varieties. For example, we had Grosso, Provence, Hidcote, Imperial Gem. We planted a very special plot of Mayette, and the Mayette field of lavender was and is still to this day specifically for essential oil. So that's been something that we've continued to this day.
What's your soil type here?
So we have clay soils, and it's been a very interesting transition on the farming end of Soul Food Farm, because we used to till here all the time and my soils were getting worse. And back in, I think, 2012, we stopped tilling, and we've been putting a lot of time and thought into building our soils up and improving the quality of our soils.
And how do you do that?
Here at our farm, I'm a firm believer that tilling the soil destroys the soil structure.
Why is that?
When you till, what you're doing essentially is you're killing all the microbiology in the soil, all the things that give soil life, all the things that create mycorrhizal fungi that build soil structure. And to rebuild soil and increase water infiltration, I started to study soil management. And this is where my recognition that animals have another role to play besides just as food is that they also have a role to play helping you build soil fertility. And so we started to bring cows onto the farm to help us with that.
How many cows?
So we have 4 cows now. And over the years, we have seen an improvement in the soil between the cow grazing and management of that, coupled with no tillage. We've seen a much better rate of water infiltration on the farm, less flooding, more soil tilth. And as I continue to work on those aspects of soil management, I'm also now getting very interested in recovering the perennial grasses on the farm and diminishing the annual grasses so that we have more forage for our animals to graze on for longer periods of time.
How do you do that?
It's a very specific and intentional way of moving your cows across your property in blocks, and for how many days and how many bites they're taking of grass, and then moving them forward. Some people call it holistic management. Other people call it grazing management. There's different books and different research, and you can look into it and see what fits into your farm and your context and your goals.
Did you teach yourself this?
No.
No.
Sort of the light bulb moment for me was when I invited Alan Savory of the Savory Institute to come to Soul Food Farm. And he agreed and he came here.
Who is Alan Savory?
So he is the founder of the Savory Institute, and he's a world-renowned speaker and advocate for building soil health and regenerative agriculture. and the role grazing animals have to play in building soil fertility. And he agreed to come here. And when I heard him speak here, all the things that I had observed on my land began to click into place. And so after I met him, I took a course from the Savory Institute on holistic management and got certified on that. And then after that, I met a brilliant man named Gabe Brown, who speaks all over the world about regenerative agriculture and soil health. He came here and taught a class at Soul Food Farm and wrote a book called Dirt to Soil. And from there, it's just a rabbit hole, and you can just read books and YouTube yourself to death.
What years was this that you were doing?
Let's see. Dad was here. So Alan must have been here in 2013 because Dad was here and they met each other. And then Gabe Brown was here maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
This is fairly recent.
Yeah.
Is Alan Savory's Institute in California? Or?
The Savory Institute is based in Colorado.
And Gabe Brown is global. His
farm is in South Dakota, but he speaks all over the world and he's been in several films, one just released by Kiss the Ground called Common Ground. It's just been released recently.
It's probably on Water Bear, which is a free streaming platform of environmental movies.
Yeah, maybe.
So do you have classes here? It sounds like you're reaching out to different individuals or groups.
We do. So part of Soul Food Farm's work is to do workshops. We're always formulating workshops each year that have to do with either the practicalities of farming. Regenerative agriculture is a big topic for us, and we host classes every year about that. And we teach flower design classes, just a myriad of things. It just depends on who's available, what my bandwidth is for the year, and what my focus is for the year. So having people come here and speak about what they've learned in the regenerative agricultural space is of great importance to me. These men probably are so busy now they could never come back here, but there are so many people working in this movement and space that I'm always reaching out to people to come and share what they know.
And how do you know about these people?
Well, Alan Savory, I saw him give a TED Talk, so I just made a cold call. And Gabe Brown was the same way. I knew about him, so I just reached out to the person who puts his calendar together. I don't know these people until they agree to come. But I can recognize people for the gifts and the intelligence that they have to offer and share. And I can recognize people who are well-spoken and are part of a movement that can move the dial. I can recognize those things. And so even if I'm nervous, I will pick up the phone and call and figure it out. I don't always have the resources to hire them, but sometimes things just work out for me. And also on their end, I think sometimes they make an extra effort to accommodate me, even if I can't pay the full speaking fee, because they realize that I'm trying to help people learn something new.
What are the speaking fees?
Well, they're a lot. They're thousands of dollars. So it's very difficult to have people here sometimes, because you'd have to sell tickets to the class that are expensive. Yeah. But so far, things have worked out. Like, they're passing through anyway on their way to Sacramento Airport, so they give me a little break because they could stop here. And then if I drive them to the airport, you know, like, people make it work. People find a way. I've been lucky like that.
But are the other people that have come?
Nicolette Han Nyman has been here.
Who is that?
She is an author and an advocate for the role cattle have in building soil and in fighting climate change. She's quite remarkable. Her husband founded Nyman Ranch, and she's quite brilliant.
And she's a cattle farmer herself?
Her and her husband both have cattle on their farm in Bolinas, but she's also an incredible published author and lecturer. Not in the cattle or regenerative ag movement, but last year I had this brilliant woman come who has been researching and groundbreaking information on saving zinnia seeds and propagating them and culturing them and creating new colors. And so she came here to talk about her book, the Zinnia Breeding Handbook. Her work is groundbreaking and remarkable. And
why is it groundbreaking?
Because no one has studied zinnia breeding in this way. It's just always been this flower that people have kind of passed by, and she's spending the time.
It's kind of a humble flower in a sense.
Yes, right? But here she is figuring out the breeding aspects of it, and it's becoming quite popular in the floral design world to use zinnias and find new colors and new palettes to work with. And I just thought, that's just an incredible thing. She took a hobby and figured it all out on her own and has written a book.
How many people came to the zinnia?
We had 10 or 15.
Are they florists or professionals?
I didn't really ask. I think some of them were farmers and maybe one was a florist, but I didn't really ask everybody. I was just so happy they bought tickets and they were there learning from her.
What I notice is that you are open to all walks of life, so to speak. It's not just professionals that are coming, but it's the person who has a backyard, but all interested in one way or another.
There's so much to learn. Oh my goodness.
You're a repository for knowledge.
Well, I want people to come here and share what they know with each other. And it's a good meeting place.
Are you open all year?
We open the farm stand March through mid-December. And then I close it down. There's so much to do here during the winter months, but people aren't fans of coming out here when it's raining. So we just close down from mid-December to the beginning of March.
When do you harvest the olives?
The olives are usually harvested in November. So we hire a crew and some friends will come out and help too, some volunteers, but we rely on our crew.
How many are on the crew?
Usually 30 people.
Ooh, a lot.
It's a big thing.
Yeah.
So we hire a crew company to come out. Sometimes we do it in 2 days. Last year we had to do it in one.
Why did you have to do it in one?
Because the cost of harvesting was so astronomical, I could not spend 2 days doing that.
What is the cost of?
The crew was about $9,000.
Oh.
The milling was about $5,000. And then all the bottles to put the olive oil in was another $6,000. It was well over $20,000 by the time we were done, before we sold anything.
And how many bottles do you have?
I bought a couple of pallets. We had 230 gallons. So when you're a small producer, you don't get the privilege of just buying what you need. So I don't have the influence or the flexibility or the size for a bottling company to be incredibly flexible and let me just buy what I need. I have to buy what makes economical sense to them. So whether I need a pallet of glass or not, that's not the question. Mm-hmm. The question is, can I afford a pallet? Mm-hmm. And so I had to buy 2 pallets. Not that I needed all of that, but that's okay. So now I have enough glass for next year, but then we have to find a place to store it. The same thing with everything. We're a small producer, so we're going to pay top dollar to take our product to a mill and get it milled. And we're also going to pay top price to get a crew out here to harvest because I'm not big enough to use them 2 or 3 or 4 times a year, which might give me a little bit of flexibility on the labor cost. I can only use them once a year, so I'm going to pay the going.
Are these
rent.
Specialty harvesters? Like, they know how to harvest
Yes.
olive trees, and that's why they're a premium?
Labor costs are just very expensive, and I think people don't understand when they're buying food directly from farmers why it can often be more expensive than what you would get in the grocery store, and you're paying for labor. We retail our olive oil for $40 a bottle. That is expressive of the labor costs. These guys harvest in olive orchards and vineyards all over Northern California. So they're experienced. So you want people who are experienced. You want people who know how to handle the kind of equipment that needs to be used. You want people that work well together. So they're a team. They've already been working together for months. And you want people who are fast and efficient. And they understand that. Mm-hmm. So having volunteer help is lovely, and I like having people come here as volunteers or friends and family to have the experience of helping in an olive orchard, but I'm not relying on them to bring in my harvest. Mm-hmm. That's Eric, me, the foreman, and this paid crew. We're bringing in the harvest. Mm-hmm. And so we start at 6 a.m. and we work until about 4 p.m, and it's just pedal to the metal.
And when you harvest in November, it sounds like.
Yeah.
What, you go to another company and they grind the olives up into olive oil?
Yes. We take our olives to the olive press in Sonoma. Great people. They do an excellent job.
How far away is that?
It's over Highway 37. If there's no traffic, 45 minutes, an hour to get there. And we usually make 2 trips. Like, there's a midday trip when someone's driving the truck there. and we keep working, and then they come back, and then we load the truck up again and take an end of the day load of
and
bins.
And who decides the taste of the olives?
The taste of the olives?
The mix.
Me. I try to do what I call an 80-20 mix, where it's about 80% ripe and 20% green olives. It fluctuates, but that's always the goal, because I like that grassy, peppery flavor of olive oil. If I wanted to have a softer tone, then I would do 100% ripe olives, and that would be a softer flavor.
How do you know when to do this?
It's a bit of a juggle, because you have to hire the crew months before you're harvesting your olives, and then you're walking through the orchard constantly as you get closer to harvest time. Last year in November, I had hired the crew the week previous, and I felt intuitively that the orchard was at the peak moment to harvest. And yet, there was rain in the forecast, so we had to cancel everything because you can't harvest in the rain. And then we had to push it another 8 or 9 days. And I felt that in that short amount of time, we had missed that peak moment and we had moved into more ripeness. It's a juggling act. It's like harvesting anything. You have to juggle it a little bit.
And are you looking at the color of the olives?
Yeah, so I can see quite clearly when the olives are hanging on the tree, what's ripe and what's not. I can literally walk through the orchard and count the trees that have green olives and black olives. So it's very obvious to me what the condition of the field is, or the grove is. It's a technical term. It's a grove, which I call an orchard, which I call a field, which is I call over there. So I use different words to describe it, but technically, it's olives in one space is called a grove, not an orchard. So a tidbit.
And then the blend itself, are you tasting at the press?
No.
Or it's already set and they go?
It's set. So all three different varieties that we grow are all mixed and harvested together. And they're all pressed together.
Yeah.
And it's pressed within 24 hours of me taking it. Sometimes within just a few hours of it arriving. But by the next day or the late afternoon of the next day, I'm picking up the olive oil. They've pressed it.
When they say virgin and extra virgin, what does that actually mean?
That requires you getting your olive tested. And it's a degree of acidity that they're testing for and other components that they're looking for that you must meet a range for it to be called extra virgin. Eric has been asking me for years to get it tested, and he's right, we should, but I never have time. We just sell it as cold pressed because that's what it is.
Is there a hot pressed?
No, it's just cold pressed, unfiltered. I have a really difficult time with labels, being told this is certified organic or that this is extra virgin. It's a personal opinion that sometimes we just overvalue things being branded and called something. Like, why can't it just be farming? Why does it have to be certified organic farm?
Are you a certified organic farm?
We used to be a certified organic farm, and then I dropped it. Not that I wanted to use pesticides or herbicides. I've never done anything like that ever, and I never would. It was just simply that I wanted to buy some plants from Morning Sun Herb Farm, and they do everything right, but they do not use a certified organic rooting hormone for propagating. And that one teeny little thing negates all the 99.99% good that they do over there. And if I had bought those plants and brought them here, I would have lost my certification. So I thought, well, I am going to buy plants from her because I'm going to support another farmer doing good work who lives next door to me. I'm going to lose the certification anyway, so I'll drop it. And I have continued to farm the way that I think is morally correct, which is not to use herbicides or pesticides on my farm. But I don't miss not having that certification. I understand its importance for many, many farmers. It's just, I can be ornery, and I just feel ornery about that, having a label on my farm. And I guess that's my same reticence about the olive oil. It should say extra virgin on the label. Eric's absolutely right, but I just drag my heels about getting it tested. I just feel like we pressed it, we did all the right things. It's delicious.
Maybe you want to say, come here and see where it grows.
I know. I don't know why I dig my heels in about things like that, but I have.
So you have the lavender business as well.
Yes.
And that's a joint venture with Rose.
Yes.
And what do you do with this lavender?
So Rose and I together have developed 10 different products. We're very passionate about the lavender essential oil we produce.
And do you produce that yourself?
Or? Yeah, so we have a copper still and we harvest the lavender by hand from that plot and we distill the lavender. And the byproduct of making...
This is the miette.
Yes, and the byproduct of making lavender essential oil is you end up with all this beautiful hydrosol or lavender water. So we have those two beautiful things that we sell, plus all the other things lavender farmers do, which is they make soaps and they make sachets. And
you make soaps?
Yeah, dried flower arrangements. Just so many products you can make from lavender. And so we do those too.
Do you cut all these plants down? How does this work?
Yeah, everything's harvested by hand. We don't have machinery to cut the lavender from our fields. We do everything by hand with small size. A small hand size.
There's some very famous paintings.
It's just small handheld ones, not the ones you swing. Mm-hmm. You just a small handheld one. So you grab a bunch of lavender, cut it at the base, and just keep on trucking.
Do you cut them all the way down to the base?
Or? So when you're doing the maillet, you're just cutting it right under the flowers. Because you don't need the stems, really, to make essential oil. When we're cutting to hang lavender to dry for wreath making, then we cut them lower down on the stem. And those are different varieties of lavender for those projects. If we're cutting lavender to make sachets with the buds of the lavender, we cut them a little bit different because we're drying them for another project. So you don't need a lot of stems for that, but you need enough stems to hang them to dry. So everything has a little variance to it.
Are you dry farming?
No, the lavender is irrigated, but lavender is a drought tolerant plant, so we're not irrigating much.
What does that mean?
It means unlike maybe vegetables, tomatoes, carrots, when during the summer you have a regular schedule to keep them hydrated and growing, lavender is drought tolerant, so it doesn't like its roots wet. It likes dry conditions. So you're keeping them hydrated to keep them alive, but you're not watering them deeply every week. And as temperatures in our region get hotter and hotter, it's good to have those irrigation lines laid out along the lavender plants just to give them a little extra burst, because sometimes it can be 115 here and
quite hot.
It can get really hot here.
You have a clay soil. And you amend that soil with... How do you do that?
We do cover crops in between the rows of the lavender.
Which cover crops are you using?
I think what I put out there last time was crimson clover. And then as far as just giving them a little biological boost, we will go out and spray the lavender with a seaweed kelp spray just for a little boost.
Through. What time of year do you do that?
You know, that's a good question because Rose manages that schedule, but a few times during the season, not when the flowers are blooming, but before bud break and at
the
end. Yeah, and then at the end again.
And do you replace lavender or is it just you went out and bought this 1,000 lavender and they just keep growing? It's a perennial? How does that?
So it is a perennial, which means it comes back every year. And if you take good care of them, they can last for as long as 15 years as a production plant. Rose propagates everything at her nursery because that's what she does. She's a plant nursery and she's an expert on propagation and lavender, actually. So whenever we need plants, she's starting them there. So last year, we had a huge loss of plant material in our field and got a disease that I don't pronounce correctly, so I'm not even going to try, but it's in the soil, and once it's in the soil, it stays in the soil. So we are moving the whole lavender field and redesigning a new one on the other side of our farm this spring and sort of starting over again.
The arable land that you're working on, how many acres is that? Because I know you have some hillside on your farm here.
Right. I would say, estimating that we probably have 30 acres of land that we can plant and grow on, but we don't use all of that. I think the olive orchard takes up 3 acres and the lavender field will only take up 1 acre. And the flowers are spread around the farm, but I think if I put it all together so that those flower plots were contiguous, it would only be 1 acre or 2. The rest of the farm is really fields. In open space. Because what I'm also working on that doesn't look like much to people from the outside is I'm working on rebuilding the perennial grasses on the farm and building the biology in the soil and sequestering carbon. So that's a whole other level of work that I do here that has its own value. And then on top of that, we are replanting trees. We lost 1,000 trees in the LNU fire.
Oh, what is that fire?
So the LNU fire...
LNU?
Yeah, swept through the whole valley and burnt it to the ground 3 years ago.
2021?
Yeah. And so we lost 1,000 trees that night.
On your property, you lost 1,000. But you didn't lose any buildings.
We didn't, because Eric and I and our daughter came home and fought the fire for 7 hours by ourselves to save our house. I am convinced if we had not returned, we would have lost our home. The olive orchard was on fire when we came back, and we were able to put out those fires, but there were about 10 trees on fire there. Our barn was on fire. We fought that fire. But our losses were minimal. In the whole valley, 300 homes burned. People died. 1,000 structures were destroyed. It was devastating wildfire.
Probably didn't have manpower to help you.
There was nobody out here helping us. So it was just a very tragic night.
Do you just have hoses? What were you doing?
No, there was no water. All the power lines had collapsed on the road. There was no water. There was no power. So Eric, Emma, and I used shovels and rakes to put out the fires.
Hitting the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it was wild. It was crazy.
Were you the only family out here?
No. A lot of people left that night. So there were properties that people had to evacuate because their lives were in danger. There was people who stayed. There were people who climbed over those hills
behind
the next day to get back to their farms because the road was closed. Mm-hmm. Eric and I ended up camping out here again for, I think it was 2 weeks or 10 days before the power came back on. Thank goodness we have great neighbors, because all our fencing burnt to the ground. So our cows, we couldn't contain them. So our neighbor was wonderful. His place did not burn, and he took our cows over there, and we had no water. So every day I had to walk across that field with a bucket, like, I don't know, some crazy version of Laura Ingalls Wilder, and fill up a bucket with water and carry it back so Eric and I could have water.
So you're on city water here?
No, we're on well water. But if you don't have power, your well doesn't work.
Oh.
Eric learned very quickly how to rig up a generator to our well. And then people were calling us to ask how we did it. And we were helping people in different parts of the valley figure it out. Everybody came together. People really helped each other out here. It was an amazing moment.
Aren't you on a farm association out here? Aren't you the president of a farm association?
So it's called the Pleasance Valley Agriculture Association, mm-hmm. and it was founded by a group of farmers and rural residents here back in, I think, 2017, 2018. And I'm the current president of it. We just turned it into a nonprofit at the end of last year.
How many members do you have?
It's a small group, 20 or 30 farmers and interested residents.
Mm-hmm.
It was really formed as an organization to band together and try and preserve this valley and keep it zoned agricultural,
mm-hmm.
and stand up to the forces of change and
development.
Is there
a threat to this?
Yes. Pleasance Valley has always been under threat of rezoning and development. And ever since I've moved here, it's been a constant concern, I think now more than ever.
And why is that now more than ever?
Because we have the pressures of developers coming in now and buying ag-zoned land. So instead of buying land that's been rezoned, developers are now coming into Solano County and Pleasance Valley particularly and making offers on ag land far beyond what ag land is valued at, gambling probably with some pretty good inside information that this land will be rezoned commercial, and so they're trying to get in ahead of the game. It's a worrisome trend, because we as farmers and rural residents, we want to keep this valley zoned ag, because what you see before you is quite unique and important in a way that maybe we didn't recognize 30 or 40 years ago, that open space. Some of us valued it, some of us didn't, but I think now we're beginning to recognize it is also a finite resource, just like water and mm-hmm. clean air and good soil. And it's important that this association is formed to stand up for the voices of farmers. Not everybody wants to sell their land. Not everybody wants to see a housing development. There's a place for everything, but I don't think it's this valley.
This sounds a bit like your parents in the Castro Valley flood.
Yeah, the Contra Costa Flood Control District. Well, you know,
it sounds like a repeat story.
Isn't that what happens in history?
Yeah.
Things repeat themselves over and over till we learn the lessons.
So you've put this organization together.
I did, and it was a group of us. I would never want to take credit for it.
As a group, you've put this together in order to hold your place.
I hope so, yeah.
To hold land.
Yes.
For future generations.
Yes. Yeah, and it's an interesting phrase because we often use that phrase for future generations, but I think of it more that we are literally just caretakers. Mm-hmm. We are just taking care of it for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an obligation to those who come after us to leave some things intact so that they have the resources to also build their lives and their societies in a wholesome way. And it's not for our children, it's for everyone, the world, it's for humanity. This is not mine.
Mm-hmm.
This is not ours. It doesn't belong to us. Mm-hmm. We're just passing through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my lifetime, in my children's lifetime, even if I planted a tree today, no one will ever see it at its full moment.
Mm-hmm.
That takes hundreds of years.
And you did mention that you lost a number of trees here.
So we lost 1,000, plus the hedgerow we planted. And so now the goal on the farm is, before I say goodbye to the world, is to plant 3,000 trees on this farm. I want to say goodbye knowing there are 3,000 trees on this property.
This is fairly consistent with chickens and lavender. And would you call this a forest or is this a tree farm? What is it exactly?
I think it's more about making space for the ecosystem to thrive, to make a space for the wildlife to regain a foothold.
So you're in the trees, because trees have very different capacities.
Yeah.
Do you have an index of trees you're intending to plant?
Yeah, I do have a list of things I'm looking at. I mean, obviously, things that are conducive to this temperature and environment, things that are natural to the place where we live, and also trees that can create food and habitat for people and animals, and trees that will dig their roots down at different depths and levels. So we have a way for water to traverse through the different layers underneath the soil.
Can you share with us some of your thoughts on the trees you would like to plant? Are you planting right now?
Yeah. In February, we put in 50 fruit trees.
Great.
On the farm.
What kind of fruit trees?
We planted fig trees, and I bought peach and cherry and persimmon, and I also put in some chestnut trees. Yeah, it was a whole array. And then I think I put in like 8 bay laurel trees.
Why bay laurels?
Because they grow huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, not only can you use the bay laurel leaves, but it's a great habitat for birds. So before the LNU fire, my dear friend Liz, who's a birder, had been counting the birds on the farm for a couple of years. And we finally had 50 species of birds on Soul Food Farm. And then after the LNU fire, the next time she came after the fire to count, we counted 10. And then finally last year, we broke 35 on her count.
Mm-hmm.
And so the birds are coming back. And I know that we can do even better than that.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the idea that if the birds are coming back and we're up to 35, then that means there's things here on the farm that they are seen as habitat for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we'll continue working towards those goals to get back up to 50 or more.
And doing any oaks?
Yeah, so up in Sacramento, there's a park up there where you can go and see all these species of oak trees. I had no idea there were so many. And next door to the park is a nursery where you can buy starts. And
oh, that's great.
I'm fascinated about buying as many of these varieties of oaks and putting a small oak grove here on the farm where someday people can come and see all these different types of oak trees.
The diversity.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think that would be really wonderful.
So, you have the right soil type here.
I think we can do it. We already have oak trees that are naturally part of the farm.
Mm-hmm. Would you have the hillsides.
Yeah. So we'll see. That's a lifelong project.
Do you irrigate these trees or?
No, we don't. I'm not opposed to, and have many times, put buckets of water in my tractor and gone around when necessary. But We plant them in late fall so that we can take advantage of the winter rains, mm-hmm. and then they can dig their roots down and get a good start before spring and summer show up.
What kind of tractor do you have, or tractors?
Oh, yeah, I have a Kubota tractor that we use around the farm. It's too much work without the right equipment.
That's a great tractor, a Kubota.
Yeah, I love it.
How old is it?
It's not old. The week of the LNU fire, we bought that, and so it's just a few years old. I really miss my old tractor. It was beat to shit, but uh-huh. I loved it.
And where did that go?
It was really at the end, so I traded it in for this, and then I called the guy back 3 days later. I'm like, I want my old tractor back. And he's uh-huh. like, we stripped it. I'm like, in tears. This one is lovely. It's just fancy.
Yeah.
And I liked my old tractor. And I could fix my old tractor. This one's fancy. I don't know what
to do. Do you fix it yourself?
The old one I could. Mm-hmm. But this one is just so much technology on it. I don't understand it. Mm-hmm.
So you've got a tree regeneration program. You have a lavender business mm-hmm. here. You have olive orchards. You are sharing with other farmers on your days that you're open. Do you have a CSA program or something like this that people do?
We don't. What we do have is a flower CSA subscription, which is a very minor little thing. I don't grow row crops, mm-hmm. and I don't grow a large diversity of food commercially, so a CSA isn't a good fit for me, mm-hmm. but I think it's a really good tool for farms. I really like that model quite a bit. And if your listeners don't know what a CSA is, it stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and is this model where before the growing season kicks in, during those quiet months when farmers don't typically have a lot of product to sell, you pre-purchase a subscription for a certain amount, and the promise is the farmer will grow your food for you during the growing season and return it to you, your investment in food, and you're paying a little bit less because you're fronting money for them mm-hmm. to get started for the season. And so you'll pay a little less for that food than when you buy it directly from them at a farmer's market in the summer. And so it helps farmers out with the cash flow problem that we all have during the winter months. And you as a subscriber know that you've invested in your farming community and that you have this beautiful, healthy food that will be coming to you in the future mm-hmm. months. It's a good model.
And do you have a membership club or something like that for Soul Food Farm?
So Soul Food Farm has what we call our private membership association, and people can join for $15 a year. And it's a way for us to keep the farm stand open, to work with farmers and keep them as part of our farm group so that we can purchase from them on a regular basis. So the farm stand was designed not only to sell our goods, but we really wanted to create a farm stand where we could buy from farmers in the local community and they could sell their goods here. And you as a consumer could find all this beautiful local farm food in one location. And so with my private membership association, you're helping support that vision. And then as part of that contribution, you get discounts on all of our workshops and tours. And at the end of the summer, we put on a farm-to-table dinner that's just for the private members. Mm. So we try to add some perks to that. But the real benefit is that you as a member are supporting local agriculture in a really profound way.
Roughly how many people are part of your club?
We have a little more than 800 private members.
It's a good number.
It's a really good number. It shows you how many people in this community really care about local agriculture and farmers. It's very hopeful.
It's a nice way for someone to participate in your future, their future.
Yeah, it's definitely a collective future.
Yes, like collective. That's a great word.
Yeah, I think people are recognizing that their dollar has incredible value and power. And when they're shopping here, they're making all sorts of statements. I don't even know if they're aware of how deep that goes. They're saying that they care about local agriculture, but they're saying they care about their purchasing power. They care about their community. There's just so many parts of shopping at a small business that they're expressing their interest and concern for. Mm-hmm.
What other farming ideas or realities are on your future?
Oh, no, I can't tell you because okay. Eric would have a fit. I don't think I have any, actually. They come at the moment. As life evolves, you go, oh, this would be fun to do.
Aren't you having a coffee bar?
Oh, yeah, the coffee bar. Well, I'm applying for a mobile coffee bar permit from the County of Solano. Yes. We'll see. I think that that would be really fun. People like coming here to the farm and having a cup of coffee and sitting under a tree and talking to their friends. I think it's just a very communal and natural thing to want to eat and drink in community with others.
Were you surprised that you were appointed Woman of the Year in 2023?
Yeah, that was a surprise.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Congressman Mike Thompson's staff reached out to me to say that he was talking to different women in the Bay Area in his districts, that he wanted to honor me as the Farmer of the Year, which I thought was really nice. I don't know why he chose me.
Did you
an
know
honor.
Him? Or?
I've met him and had arranged previously a chance for farmers to meet him and talk to them about their concerns.
Was this through your group?
Yeah. Months before that, I had arranged for farmers in Pleasance Valley to meet him. And he came out and talked to them, and he was great. And I think that it really helped farmers to feel like they were seen and heard. I didn't realize. So what happens is I go to this presentation, which I almost didn't go to. And my daughter was having none of that. She's like, you're going. So I went, and I was just so blown away. It was in a beautiful winery. He rolled out the red carpet for these women that he was honoring. The company I was in was so lovely. And I never read that plaque that day. I didn't know what it said until a couple of days later I read it and was floored. And
what then, floored you?
I think I had assumed in my mind everybody was just getting sort of a generic plaque. Mm-hmm. And when I read it, it was so personal to my work and me. And then I realized that he had done the same for every other woman that he had honored. And I just thought that was remarkable.
How many women were there?
There were five of us.
I see.
But the thing that really floored me is he read each woman's plaque on the floor of the House of Representatives. So it is in the official congressional record. And when I read my plaque and it all clicked, mm-hmm. I just was overwhelmed. That was, to me, much more than just saying these women have done good work in their communities. That told me that this man, this congressman, really feels that the people in his community are important. So now it's an official record in the Congress, and I'm thrilled. They mentioned Pleasance Valley Agriculture Association on that plaque, and they mentioned Solano County farmers. It's a big deal.
As you go forward here, I think you will have challenges and great results, but you're a community. You've organized the community.
Well, I like people, and I like being part of things.
But we all like people.
I know, but
I think you go a step further.
Yeah, maybe I do.
Not all of us have a farm stand, by example.
The older I get, the more I feel like I just want to do something of service. And I feel less like a farmer, and I feel less knowledgeable, and I feel less ownership, and I feel less of everything. And I think only about what I can learn and if I could spend more time with people.
In wrapping up, in reading the proclamation that the senator wrote and researched, the focus seems to be advocacy, that you are an advocate, a political advocate for small farmers. Would you agree with that? Or
I would like to be a voice for agriculture. Mm-hmm. I think that's an aspiration. Mm-hmm. Have I achieved that? I don't know, but I aspire to that. I would like to be a voice for farmers in agriculture, absolutely.
And I think Solano County, where we are, as everyone is listening to this, is headed for a very big showdown between farmers and developers. It's Free California is the name of the developer.
California Forever.
Oh, California Forever.
Yeah.
That's a little bit ironic in that it's all about building and taking over ag land.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, you are headed towards quite a showdown, wouldn't you say?
I think that particular situation has created a demarcation line in this community between people who are going to take their money and people who are not, and people who are going to stand up with their farmers and stand for their farmers and people who are not.
You know, I don't judge any of the farmers who sold to the Flannery Group because I understand that in farming, you are making a lot of decisions when you sell your land that have nothing to do with farming and have everything to do with family decisions and legacy decisions. But there's a lot of people in this community who feel that they want to do business with the Flannery Group. And there's a lot of people in this community who feel that that's not the correct thing to do. And so one thing they have been very successful at is creating a lot of division in our community. I don't know what the answer to that is. And I don't even think there is one particularly. I mean, when people are billionaires and want to buy their way in to a community and achieve the goals that they've set for themselves, I don't see anybody who can stand up against that kind of money. But the one thing this community can do is keep the land zoned agricultural. That is within our power and our sphere of influence. And so developers are going to buy land. I think that they better be very aware that there are people in this community who are going to fight to keep it zoned agricultural. I hope they're willing and interested.
That's called the showdown.
Yeah, there you go. I guess you're right. That's a great term for it. I think that is the showdown.
Yeah.
I have no opinion about the Flannery Group because I don't have time to waste thinking much about them. But I do know that the job is to keep farmland intact. Not because I'm necessarily a farmer that I feel so opinionated about that, but I can see the broader scope here. As our resources are dwindling, farmers are much more than a cute little side note to our communities. We're a food security issue. And I think when COVID happened and we saw supply chains collapse and food raided from the stores, it was the farmers actually in these small communities all over the country who were able to bridge that gap. CSAs exploded all over the country. And because there was one degree of separation, it was literally the field, the farmer, the shopper. We were able to distribute food fast to people. So I think it's short-sighted to look at development in the same way that we used to look at it in the 80s, where it was all about money and opportunity and sprawl, the personal advantages people received. I think now we have to look at it and go, oh, it also, along with water and clean air and good soil, is a limited resource, and we have to be more thoughtful about our agriculturally zoned lands. I don't know what people think they're going to do if we don't have clean food to eat. You're not going to make it far into your life living on Doritos and fast food. We know that that kind of food causes long-term health issues for people. So we have to look at small farmers because we're the ones who can access people directly in an emergency as a valuable asset. Even commercial farms, they're so complicated, they cannot distribute food in the same way because they're working through wholesalers and distribution centers. You really need small farmers who can reach people fast and efficiently.
Well, a cellular distribution in a sense.
Yeah. So I think we have a role to play here that's beyond just, you know, we love our farmers. No, we actually have a role to play in your food security and in your community as a whole.
I think it's important to hear that. What I meant about this group, to clarify, wasn't so much the group, but the intention.
Yeah.
So it's two different intentions that are, in a sense, at cross purposes with each other.
Yeah. So to me, the brutality of this situation is not building the housing development they talk about. The brutality is that they have removed 70,000 acres of agricultural land from our community.
That's
a lot. This is horrifying. Mm-hmm. And it was going to have long-term effects that we can't only begin to think about because it's an enormous amount of land that's been removed from food production. And they keep telling people publicly that it was bad land and it was no good for farming. That is just such an exaggeration. None of these families would have been farming there since the 1850s until today if it was bad farmland. And it just shows you how investors whose business is making money, who have no connection to agriculture, can make these kind of blanketed statements that are not based in any truth or reality. That was grazing land, huge land production, wheat production, alfalfa. Those were thriving agricultural businesses. and it's gone now. And even if they never build a house, no farmer will be able to buy that land back because the Flannery Group bought it for 3, 4, 5 times more than it was worth. So it's already beyond anything that a farmer could ever buy back. Housing development or no housing development, that land is out of production.
And I think of the birds that you talked about and creating diversity for feeding different types of groups of animals in our life. Not just butterflies, bees, frogs, newts, you name it, squirrels, chipmunks, voles, whatever it is. You're basically removing large segments of our natural population. Would you say that?
I absolutely agree. Humankind, citizens, they are so removed from nature that they don't understand that all these small creatures in and of themselves may seem silly to talk about or could not have a possible impact. They don't understand that their disappearance is indicative of ecosystem collapse. And we are all part of this ecosystem. And so you cannot have healthy food and healthy water and clean soil. And if you don't have all of these parts functioning in your ecosystem, they are all indicative of the health of your environment. And so they're much more important to everybody's well-being than they've realized. Mm-hmm. So yes, the newts and the moles and the butterflies and the dragonflies and all of these creatures show us how our atmosphere is healthy or degraded. And that impacts people's health and well-being. They don't know it, but it's a direct link.
So they are our canaries.
Yes, absolutely, 100%. So when people come out here, I can't tell them all these things, but I can say, sit under that tree, go walk in the olive orchard, and they come back time and time again and say, we feel so good here. Mm-hmm. And little by little, those things begin to raise in them other questions mm-hmm. and other expectations.
Thank you.
Thank you, too, for asking all these wonderful questions. It's been a pleasure.
It is a great pleasure, and everyone plant a tree.
Yes, absolutely.
And visit Soul Food Farm.